China became all of a sudden very aggressive and assertive, actually. I'll use the word assertive, not aggressive. There's a big difference between the two. This is known as the Year of Assertiveness, 2009 to 10. China went out and started picking fights or had disturbances with all of its neighbors, with South Korea, with Japan, with India, with Australia, with several of the ASEAN states in Southeast Asia, with the European Union, with the United States. It was probably the worst year in Chinese diplomacy in the post-Mao era, 2009 to 10. There was certainly a pattern there. What started this? It's hard to say. I'd say we still only speculate about it. But after a year of strained relations with all those countries, Hu Jintao began the process of renormalization. Xi Jinping comes into power and inherits that, which I'll leave to Bob Sutter to discuss. But the last 3 years of Hu Jintao's foreign policy were really affected by this assertiveness. It really soured relations and undercut 10 years of very hard work by the Chinese government, and I think very positive work. China's foreign relations under the Hu Jintao period, as I say, primarily very positive. Well, then, overnight, just like June 4th, but the end of the Hu Jintao period really shifted. He didn't really leave office with a particularly sound foreign relations. Last point about Hu Jintao, and then I'll stop. Soft power. Which is still very important, and indeed today's event is an example of China's growing soft power in the world, an attempt to project China's image onto the global stage. But that began where? It began in 2007 at the 17th Party Congress, when Hu Jintao first used the term Ran Shirli in his speech. He said, "We Chinese have to go out and build soft power in the world." And so that's a continuity. It started with Hu Jintao, continues to this day. Chinese government poured billions, somewhere around $10 billion a year or more, into various efforts to improve its international image. So that may be something we'll remember Hu Jintao for. So I will stop there and turn it over to my colleague, Professor Sutter, who will pick up the story with Xi Jinping. Thank you.
Too, I'm very grateful to be for the organizers to be invited to speak with you today. Welcome to the campus. GW is a really exciting school, lots of different things going on. I've taught in a lot of places in Washington, taught at SAIS and AU, in Georgetown, and University of Maryland, and you name it, UVA. GW is sort of unique. They never rest on their laurels, and they're always trying to make it better. And so it's a great place to be. So I really like it very much. And what I'd like to talk with you today, I can't cover everything about this period. I think David has given us a very good introduction as to where we have come. Xi Jinping basically enhanced these types of assertive types of actions on the part of China in foreign affairs, the expanding interests, and this has led to a lot of problems for the United States. And of course, those of you that are in Washington, you're familiar with this. We're undergoing a lot of debate about China in the United States right now. And I think a lot of this rests on Xi Jinping and what he's doing. You may remember Barack Obama. Remember him? He's a very nice man, it seemed to me. I liked him very much. And he had a way of dealing with China, which was, I thought, pretty effective, but it wasn't strong enough. And so Xi Jinping just kept challenging him in a whole variety of ways while being nice at the same time. And he did this in a whole range of areas. You see it in the in economic practices, you see it on territorial expansion, you see it in military advances, you see it in dealing with U.S.-backed international norms and institutions, and opposition to U.S. influence in various ways. And where I saw it, and the thing that really tipped me over, is the way he deals with Russia, with Putin. you examine this closely. This really tipped me over. I said, Xi Jinping's working with Putin all the time. What senior leader in the world spends more time with Putin than anybody else? Xi Jinping. And so when I saw that, I said, oh, yes, they're assertive. And so my topic today is look at Xi Jinping's vision in foreign affairs. And the vision is quite dramatic. It's a wonderful vision, beautiful. But it's all about China. So if you look at the recent party congress in October, all about the vision of China, there's nothing in there about the neighbors. It's all about China. And China's going to expand, it's going to be more influential, and it's going to do all this and that. At whose expense? Well, that's never addressed. And so what we have is a lot of publicity about China, about Xi Jinping, about how powerful China is. And so as an analyst of this type of situation, I find myself saying, well, how do we understand this in the United States? Is the vision of Xi Jinping's China, is this going to be, are they going to dominate Asia? Are they going to try to dominate something else in their pursuit of the China dream? Because one thing about the China dream, it's very self-righteous, extremely self-righteous, as China is in foreign affairs. You all know, the People's Republic of China has never made a mistake in foreign affairs. You all know that, right? If you find one, if they admit that, would you please come see me? I'm keeping track. They never have. And so, because they follow principles, it leads to moral behavior, it leads to good stress. So this kind of a country expanding is a little worrisome to me. And so I look at it and I say, what's going to happen when they conflict with Japan, with Korea, with Taiwan, with India, with Vietnam? Well, they just have to get out of the way, I guess. And so I'm not sure that's going to happen. And of course, a lot of these countries are allies and partners of the United States. And so the U.S. has a big role and a big stake in this part of the world. And so I'm concerned about this, but I'm not as concerned as some people. Some people say we've got to knuckle down and we've got to contain China, we've got to struggle with China. I said, well, maybe. Maybe China's going to be dominant in areas that we might have to worry about in the West, and we in the United States in particular have to worry about. And this vision connotes that type of thing. But I think there are some continuities in Chinese foreign relations which I think bear witness. And I want to go through those now, because they give me some rest. I don't get too concerned. And there are five continuities that are constraining China. We all know about Chinese strengths because the Chinese publicity department works overtime to tell you about them. There are all sorts of things. It's an amazing operation. David can help me on this, but I understand there are six Xitong in China. And one of them is publicity.
Shenzhou.
And so you've got hundreds of thousands of people working on this issue, making China look great, and making Xi Jinping look greater than ever. And so you get overwhelmed with that. So you have to be sort of nerdy and go in and say, well, what's really going on? So I'm going to just give you a picture on the other side. We all know the economic strengths. We all know the military strengths. We all know the political strengths, diplomacy, all this sort of stuff. We all know that. And so what I want to do is say, well, what are the constraints? There are five of them. Domestic preoccupation. China looks out, but it really has to look in. It still looks in. This is very important. Second, strong interdependence. China's very interdependent. It's not able to throw its weight around easily because it's complicated. I'll explain it in a minute. China's position in Asia. David's right. China has been reaching out to other parts of the world, but Asia remains the crux. Asia is the key area. 70% of Chinese foreign activity is in around the rim of China. And it's so important for China. And my point is China going to throw its weight around in other parts of the world if it's not secure in Asia? And I say, no. And so therefore, are they secure in Asia? And I would say, no. And I'm going to try to explain that. And then Chinese international economic policies get so much publicity. This Belt and Road Initiative, this type of thing, it makes China look, people talk about $1.3 trillion worth of this and $1.3 trillion worth of that. Well, let's take a look at it. We can look at it. We have a past record to look at. And so I'm going to look at that a little bit. And then I'm going to look at my country, the USA, tired, you know, with an erratic leader, this type of thing. I'm going to take a look at it and see what that means for this equation. Because I think that's a constraint on China, too. So let me go through that. Domestic preoccupations. I don't have time for all of these. But this is a country that doesn't have strong, lasting leadership legitimacy. They don't. They have to have good performance. It's very important to them. If they have good performance, it makes it hard to stay in power. And so they don't elect people in that sense. They don't have that type of thing. They have a variety of difficulties internally. Lots of disruptions, what they call mass incidents, this type of thing. And they spend an awful lot of money trying to control the people of China. And just looking at it from an internal security point of view, you know, things that keep in security inside the country, they spend more on their internal security than they do on their national security. They spend a lot on their national security. And this doesn't count the things that the publicity department does and monitoring the internet and this type of thing. And so the idea that China will, and this will be very important in foreign affairs, because in foreign affairs, China doesn't give away money. It doesn't give things away. Why? They need that at home. They have all these things they have to keep that money for, to be prepared to deal with various contingencies. They're not prepared to be generous overseas in a big way. And I'll get into that in a minute. And then the main economic problem is they're following an economic model that Japan pioneered, and it's been developing in other countries as well. And it leads to, if they're not careful, it leads to a fate like Japan, which is stagnant growth. And they're very worried about this. And they have 60 clusters of reforms of their economy. And yet, they're not really doing it. These clusters have been there since 2013, 5 years, and the reforms have been going only piecemeal. So these are some of the domestic preoccupations that they face. On interdependence, the big calling card for China, of course, is trade. China's economic importance and trading importance. And yet half of the Chinese trade is done by foreign invested enterprises in China. This is very interdependent. And we all know about the production chains and how they go from one place to another. And at the end of the day, somebody has to consume this stuff. And a lot of it doesn't go to outside of, if not, a lot of it goes outside of China. So this is very interdependent. And of course, China's interdependent on energy supplies and resources because the U.S. controls the sea lanes that this stuff travels through. So they have reasons to have to get along with the United States and other countries. And then China's position in Asia. Since the end of the Soviet Union, China's been able to spread its influence in Asia. That's over 25 years. How are they doing? Just do a snapshot. How are they doing? There are three other big powers in Asia: Russia, Japan, India. How are they doing? Russia, good. Closer than ever. Japan, worse than ever. India, worse than it was 10, 15 years ago. Is it hostile? No, it's wary. Let's take middle powers that rely on China, like South Korea. Over 20% of South Korean exports go to China. Australia. They had better relations with these countries 10 to 15 years ago than they do now. These countries are wary of China. And so you look around the rim of China, and they have a whole series of problems. And this is the most important area in Chinese foreign relations. It's important for their sovereignty issues. This is the only place where they really have big security issues. This is the only place where the PLA is in any size. And it's very important for the Chinese economy. They need a stable environment to develop their economy. And these countries individually are more important. So China is the biggest trader in Africa. I guess you know that. For many years, they did more trade with South Korea than they did with all of Africa. So they're very important. And yet their relationship is very checkered. And this is after 25 years of trying. So this is the point I'm getting at, is that this is a continuity. They have problems. What's the biggest problem? On the one hand, the biggest problem is we want to be benign to these countries, we want economic largesse to them, we want to work with them cooperatively, and we want their territory, and we want them to defer to us on a variety of issues. It doesn't work very well. It's a problem. Okay, so I can see you're not that interested in it, so I'll get to the Belt and Road. Everybody's interested in the Belt and Road. Okay, the Belt and Road is a big deal, obviously. It's a very big deal. But the point is, please, let's examine it. Let's look at the substance of what is going on. We've had 15 years of going out strategy in China. We have a record. This is not that different. And what they're doing in the Belt and Road is very similar to what they did in going out. Different motives, higher publicity levels, identified with Xi Jinping. But basically, it's the same freaking thing. And after over a decade of Chinese going out in Africa, for example, The Economist did a wrap-up in 2015. Is that China accounts for 5% of the foreign investment in Africa. And others did the same thing in Latin America. 5% of the foreign investment in Latin America. Look at the figures in Asia. Look at ASEAN figures. It's about Chinese investment, Chinese trade. It's not dominant. It might be 10% if you include Hong Kong, according to ASEAN figures. And so the point here is that China's significant, it's a new actor, it's an important actor in the field, but it doesn't dominate. And with the Belt and Road Initiative, I'd like to point out this. Xi Jinping announces the Maritime Silk Road. He goes to Indonesia in 2013, announces his Silk Road, promises the Indonesians about $30 billion worth of help. And an Indonesian think tank at the same time did a good study and said, yes, in the past 10 years in this going out strategy, they promised us about $30 billion in help, and we've gotten about 7% of that. It's a lot they don't do. And so it's very important to keep this in mind, if you don't mind. And the point that I'm underlying here is that China isn't about to give away things. A small point, China still receives foreign assistance, over $6 billion a year. So this is the kind of superpower we're dealing with. It's a very peculiar picture. Why do they do this? They need the money at home. When they negotiate these arrangements, it's win-win, and they have to win, and they want to get paid back, and they usually are very strict about it. Okay, the final point is the American constraint, and it's particularly important in Asia. And America in Asia is quite important, as we know. And I think it's still very important under Donald Trump. He's not doing so well economically, it seems, but strategically, militarily, he's doing fine. I mean, we have a strategy dealing with Asia. We're boosting our presence in Asia more than ever. It's going to be stronger than ever. And why is this important? Well, in Asia, governments matter. They make the decisions in foreign affairs. And they want development, that's where the legitimacy rests. But to get development, they need stability. But who's gonna make Asia stable for them? And what they find is that they don't trust their neighbors. They don't trust each other. In Northeast Asia and Southeast Asia, both, same, don't like each other. So where do they get stability? Well, the United States provides it. It's very expensive. It's $150 billion a year. And American people go there, and they're willing to get killed if necessary to keep stability in Asia. And they know, these government leaders know, no one else will do this. And so they need this. China's not going to do this. And they understand that. And so the bottom line here is that the Chinese run up against that, they run up against these constraints. And my sense is that this Xi Jinping vision in foreign affairs will encumber a whole series of constraints. And there will be unhappiness in China about this. What exactly will happen, I don't know. How they'll deal with that, I don't know. But I think my sense is, if I have to project, it will be a very mixed picture of China rising in Asia. It will not be a free rise by any means. And I think they will remain quite constrained for the foreseeable future. So China has momentum. It's going to be more influential in Asia. But the Americans have inertia. And they've been in Asia in these very solid positions for decades. And I think they're just going to be there as we go forward. So thank you for your attention. It's a perspective on Xi Jinping's vision. There's a grand vision, and the reality will be something much less.
CDSGT, a very new organization. Especially, I'm very grateful for they picked up a much younger picture for this pamphlet. And I think it's great to have such a honest kind of opportunity to share some views with two American professors I respected very much. And also, I think it's a very good platform to exchange the different ideas. And the key here is we all agree to disagree. And as a Chinese, I would like to provide some Chinese perspectives and observations, and which might be very different from our American friends in some aspects. And for example, just now, I think, you know, I think the two professors all mentioned continuity and changes. I agree with that. That's also one of the two keywords for my presentation. And I think we agree with a lot of things. But also, I think to some point I might disagree. For example, I think just now Professor Sutter mentioned China had never admitted had made a mistake in foreign policy making. I really think it didn't. I really don't think so. Because look at why we can see so many changes in foreign policy of China in the past decades. It means something I think China think is good. We should be continued, but something might be wrong or was wrong. So we need changes, and so we did have changes. That means we admit. No. Every leader is a man. All women, they will make mistakes. The same case for the country. So I think China is always learning, but learn how to behave in the world with its, you know, changing positions and changing powers. So I would like to say, fortunately, later I might have more agreement with the two professors, and that is I would like to start my presentation by discussing the three continuities, as well three changes in foreign policy of China since the Deng and Puxi. The first continuity is I agree with that they are. From Deng and Puxi, the top priority of China is always to strengthen its comprehensive national power and consequently to enhance the national positions and status of China. And through the path of peaceful rights, I think that's one of the key issues has been adhered by different generations of Chinese leadership. And China always believed that to address the domestic problems and challenges and fulfill economic modernization based on political and social stability is the irreplaceable and maybe most important pillar for the comprehensive national power and international status of China. It's the right way to do, and I think the Beijing believe it's the only right way to do for China to follow, I think. The third continuity is I agree with Professor Tucker's observation is China is still, until now, I think, highly domestic preoccupation. That is means that foreign policy must serve the economic modernization strategy of China, and the major purpose is to build a peaceful and stable international environment which is conducive to economic development of China. So we can see that in the past several decades, China has resolved all the land border disputes with 12 neighbors.